This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar. Splash mode. Hell on up. I'm put on sale.
Get around and hey,
hey, hey.
Good morning.
Good morning. It's KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial. It's the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. That's Abe Proctor. I'm Joe Uris. Number to call 231-8187. The reason why I'm talking so fast, we got a hell of a show.
Yeah, we do.
I mean, it's really hot.
Yeah, totally. It's
Go
totally hot.
Go
so hot.
Hot.
Yeah.
All right.
Last week, the president gave a speech in which he said the United States is going to retreat from a permanent war footing, and that would be the end of the war on terror. I don't believe him.
No.
Okay. Well, no. That's our show.
That's it.
Thanks,
goodbye,
everybody.
All right.
No, it just ain't so. It just ain't so.
Well, what do you mean?
Well, he said a number of things at this speech.
Yes.
He said America was at a crossroads. He says it's time to redefine the global war on terror as it has existed since the post-9/11 era, and that it's time for the United States to step back, lest that conflict define us, he said.
Well, that's nice, except the war
yeah,
footing has defined us since 1914.
At least 1914.
Oh, yeah. Well, we'll talk about that a bunch. And I mean, it. Go ahead.
Well, okay, I'll go ahead.
Talk about Obama.
Talk about Obama. Here's what he said. Our systematic effort to dismantle terrorist organizations must continue, but this war, like all wars, must end. That's what history advises. It's what our democracy demands. And he went on to invoke James Madison's famous warning against a country on a permanent wartime
footing. Yeah,
right. He says our systematic effort to dismantle terrorist organizations must continue. Well, isn't that the war on terror? Isn't it a systematic effort to dismantle?
I mean, there's so many weird things about the concept of war on terror. It's like war on drugs. How can it end?
Well, yeah, my point exactly. He says, well, we're going to keep doing what we've been doing, but the war is over.
Right, and we're going to transfer the drones to the military from the CIA, which somehow is better.
Well, he never actually said that.
No, not in that speech.
No, he did not. But we're going to touch on that a little bit later.
Yeah.
I just don't buy it. They were really nice words. They're like a lot of nice words that this president says. He says them in a stirring way. He's a brilliant... His rhetoric is brilliant. His oratory is brilliant. But I just don't buy it.
Well, you mean like maybe he's just another one of the long list of phonies that get to be president of the United States? Is that what you're saying?
Well, indirectly, yes. Directly, I'm saying he's proclaiming, in essence, the end of the war on terror. And one must presume, by extension, the end of the surveillance state and the detention state established under George W. Bush. He wants to close the detention center at Guantanamo Bay, the great enduring symbol of that detention state.
But he's busted using the Espionage Act of 1917-18, he has busted people within his own administration for talking to the press. And now everybody's shutting up.
I agree. Which, again, is why I think this might be a lot of nice-sounding words, but it's not going to amount to much.
Well, no.
No. And as you say, the country's been on a permanent war footing since at least 1918. One might argue that war-making has been a principal component of our imperialist expansion since we were founded
in
the late 1700s.
You can't make an omelet without breaking eggs.
Well, no, you can't make an empire without busting some heads.
Yeah. So.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, let's start out with the reality. The reality is the creation of this country, which was the first modern republic of any significance whatsoever, was a very limited democracy. Most people could not vote, and until 1920, a majority of the people could not vote. In fact, people without property couldn't vote, Native Americans couldn't vote, African Americans couldn't vote, women couldn't vote. I mean, that's most people.
That is most people.
And then there were struggles by the people throughout this history to build a greater level of democracy. And so in a way, we can say that American history is progressive because these achievements were made. But they were made always in the context of an overwhelming patriotic message, a message that allowed for genocide, a message that allowed for a long time for slavery, a message that allowed for the disestablishment of women as citizens. All that really did happen, and it didn't happen by accident. And it was a great struggle to get those rights established, but in that process, the enormous weight of propaganda, and I'll talk about modern propaganda in a while, but the great weight of propaganda, of lies, of deceits, of distortions, overwhelmingly shaped the ideology of the United States.
How did these two things exist in opposition like that?
Well, that's
how do we simultaneously manifest a drive towards greater freedom, greater equality, and at the same time move towards a more totalitarian, more imperialist?
In two ways. First of all, it's a mistake to think that there was not an enormous struggle, a very brave struggle on the part of people who saw that democracy should be extended to all of the people. And therefore, that accommodating that is the other part of that. You accommodate that within the context of a kind of an overwhelming assumption of greatness, the uniqueness of America, the God-chosen nation.
I see.
Well, and that's not, I mean, that's not an exaggeration. It is, however, in 1917, 1918, 1919, that we see the formalization of that process in the form of propaganda.
Is this the same spirit that animated Manifest Destiny, for example?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But Manifest Destiny existed long before this. I mean, Manifest Destiny, without that name, existed in the assumptions of Jefferson, for example.
Sure.
Jefferson didn't care about Native Americans. In fact, what he wanted to do was move all Native Americans to the other side of the Mississippi River.
Yeah. Yeah. You know,
and, of course, he kept his slaves, don't forget.
Of course he did.
You know, so.
Yeah. Of course he had relations with them, too.
Relations?
Relations.
Well, yes. he had. Subsequent to him, there are relations.
But you're right.
Because he had relations.
He did.
Sorry.
Okay.
Yeah.
But you're right. Manifest Destiny, this belief by the founders that this great unspoiled continent full of seemingly limitless resources was this great tabula rasa was given us by God to exploit.
Yeah, you know, I even had an instructor at CCNY in New York,
mm-hmm.
who was a visiting instructor from the University of Texas, and he argued that any estimate of the population of Native Americans in Latin America, which is what he was teaching, or North America, was a great exaggeration, that there were very few people, there was very little, there was nothing we could call civilization.
Mm.
And this was in 1961. But, you know, but that was his position, and it was an upheld position.
Not the great Mesoamerican civilizations?
Well, he dissed them. He dissed
Mississippian them. Civilization?
Yeah, no, never mind that.
Never, not the sophisticated trading cultures that existed here?
Forget
in the
about
Northwest?
It. Forget about it. Forget
okay.
about it.
All right.
Brown-skinned people don't do that.
Not the nomadic plains cultures?
None of that.
All right.
Nah, not important.
Not important.
No. Steel. Guns. That's important.
So what is it about the year 1918
well,
that's so significant?
First of all, the United States had, I don't want to get into, this is a long and extensive argument, but basically in that period, 1918, thereabouts, you see the beginning of true propaganda in the modern sense, a combination of Pavlovian ideas, Pavlov being the guy who talks about, you know, not bypassing the brain to teach, basically. You see Freudian ideas, that is the idea that you use emotion rather than rationality to persuade. And one of the leaders of this was a guy named Edward Bernays. Now, the way to remember his name is to think of Bernays sauce,
mm-hmm.
but it's spelled B-E-R-N-A-S-E.
Oh.
Okay. And he, along with Carl Beyer and many, and John Price Jones and others, created the propaganda ministries of World War I. The Committee on Public Information, also known as the Committee on Public Education, which went to work to convince everybody that the Germans were horrible. They invented all kinds of incredible crimes. I think it was a wheelbarrow full of the eyes of their victims. allegedly existed. Nuns in Belgium were raped. Children were killed at the ends of bayonets. None of which happened. None of
now,
which
now, see,
was
the true. Eyes sounds a little far-fetched, but the other stuff you'd think.
Well,
it's possible, right?
Possible. Any of it's possible. It's just not so. There's a lot of possibilities here. And, you know, I think one of the touchstones that helps people understand this is in 1948, George Orwell wrote the most famous of all the books about this sort of thing, 1984. He just flipped the numbers.
Hmm.
And he talked about a continuous war state with a virtually nameless opposition overseas about whom the people knew nothing.
Oceania has always been at war with Eurasia.
Oh, always, always.
Will always be at war with Eurasia.
Right. So, I mean, that is the kind of the culmination of the recognition among the intellectual community of what the hell had been going on for so long.
You know, what really stuck with me just now was the use of emotion rather than reason to convince.
Yeah, the guy who was really the head of this Committee on Public Information, Later Education, was a guy named George Creel, C-R-E-E-L. And there was the Espionage Act of 1917 and then the Sedition Act of 1918, both of which were used essentially to destroy the IWW, to break the Socialist Party. This was before the split between the Socialists and the Communists, to smash the left in America and to put people in jail, and to illegally deport huge numbers of foreign-born Americans.
Really?
Yeah, really, truly. And this really did happen, and from that point on, going into the 1920s and the great economic growth of the 20s, well into the modern time, well into our own time, this kind of propaganda has been effective. I mean, when you look at the clients of Bernays, who was a PR guy, one of the early PR guys, he improved the image of John D. Rockefeller. He worked for Coolidge. He worked for Procter & Gamble. He worked for CBS in its early days. He worked for United Fruit. He worked for the American Tobacco Company, persuading us that tobacco was good for us. You know, I mean, right, you know, great. He worked for General Electric. And interestingly enough, just as an aside, he worked for the pro-fluoride element in the Public Health Service.
Oh, really?
That was a discovery. I thought, whoa,
right.
Going way back,
well,
whoa.
Having just experienced that debate, I can say unequivocally that there was nothing but reason was used in that debate. And there were no appeals to emotion.
Really? And what they developed was the concept of third-party authority. That is, there are these authorities who are neutral, scientific persons who examine any issue and give you the facts. This third-party authority comes from major figures in the intellectual community, from major figures in the religious community, from major figures in the political community. And that authority then goes unchecked. For example, in the fluoride debate that just happened here, I know many, many good, serious liberal and left people who said, for the teeth. We want fluoride for the teeth. And their authority was documentation, which basically was classic examples of third-party authority. When you start examining that information, you start parsing it more carefully, you discover, fluoride helps, but it may not be the best way to deliver it to the whole body, to deliver it to the whole community, to deliver it to the whole world.
Now, I'm having a little disconnect here.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Scientific consensus exists, right? It is a real thing. It does have a useful role to play in the world, doesn't it?
Well, of course.
It does help establish a baseline from which we understand the world.
Well, yes, but you know, one of the things that we all do, left and right, is to call upon third-party authority rather than upon fact. A famous talking blues against atomic energy and atomic war has the line, "When Einstein's scared, I'm scared." We're turning to the authority of Albert Einstein. We're not looking at the issues. Now, it happens that I believe that it's correct.
Well, right.
It doesn't mean that it's always false.
Einstein was more than simply a symbolic authority figure.
Yes.
He was also a physicist.
Yes.
Who had every right to be scared about
it. No, don't get hung up on whether or not Einstein was right. Just think about the idea of turning to a third-party authority.
Okay, I understand that. What I'm saying is I think that approach makes sense in a great number of cases.
Well, of course it does.
Okay.
It's all rational, and it all becomes embedded in the culture to a great degree. Now, the attempt to make us concerned about atomic energy failed because the overwhelming public relations campaign was in favor of atomic energy. When I was a kid, I learned that soon we would be driving automobiles that would have atomic engines, that airplanes would have atomic-powered engines. This was an assumption, you know. And in fact, we did attempt to develop profitable atomic energy. The Savannah was the first commercial carrier of cargo that had an atomic energy system, and it failed, by the way. We now have atomic-powered submarines and atomic-powered other ships. And we use depleted uranium as a weapon of war, a horrible weapon of war. We have accepted the atomic age wholesale because it was effectively propagandized.
In part by appealing to this third-party authority source.
Well, yes. And
as a way to assuage the fears of the
public.
Right.
And the ultimate third-party source is patriotism.
Ah.
You can't argue that the United States is... You can't say the United States isn't under attack from the terrorists. You could see it. You know? You could see it. And, of course, it's terrible to have to use drones to knock these people out. But what's the choice? Remember how we as a nation were accepting of a war in Iraq that had nothing to do with 9/11.
You're right, and remember this one, of course. Well, you oppose the war in Iraq. Well, don't you support the troops?
Exactly, and the creation. One of the things that happened at the end of the Vietnam War was essentially a decision by the military-industrial complex to move away from a citizen army by ending the draft and creating opportunity for working class men and women to be in the armed services, to be part of a professional army that would be even more removed from access to or control by the American people.
Easy to keep a war going permanently if there's not much evidence of that war happening.
Right, and all you have to have is a lousy economy for a few years to get a good army.
Right. I guess you're seeing why drones are so politically attractive.
Oh, yeah.
To a war-making
regime.
It's
clean.
Oh, it is.
Now, you see a
at least on this end, it's clean. It's not.
Well, it's not clean
so
for the people who are on the other
no.
end, right? But you see, when you think about this, you see a linkage between popular Freudian psychology, the ideas of guys like Walter Lippmann, the ideas of innumerable parties, and by the way, in 1934. The same PR people were working for Goebbels in Nazi Germany, supporting IG Farben and other companies like that. So they're international in their perspective. They're patriotic when they talk about the home front, but that's just a technique. And I want to give credit here because a lot of this comes from Chris Hedges, who is a great journalist and a guy I really respect.
Okay, I think we should probably then segue into talking about how the use of emotion rather than reason to persuade is essentially what undermines or underlies the entire advertising industry.
Well, of course.
That's an extension of that same propaganda system.
Right, and there's been lots of, it's not new with us here, I should say. We know about this for a long, long time. We know how tobacco was linked to sexuality, and I don't need to go into all the physiology of and the presentation of it as an oral fixation. We know that the big, beautiful car is a symbol of male power or of pleasure. You know, mm-hmm. we can see all the manipulations, but we also, even as we see them as a people, succumb to them.
And that's why the war on terror is not going to end.
Well, it can't end. I mean, first of all, it's a war against a thing.
Yeah.
You can't
yeah.
end a war against a thing. Second of all, the history of the United States has been, what has it been, 27 times that we've deployed troops since World War II.
Well, at least that many.
At least. And the fact of the matter is that we are a nation constantly at war. Now, one of the things that's happened consequent to the development of drones and this army of volunteers is that the actual defense budget has shrinked, which makes it even easier to conduct wars.
We should probably go to the phones.
I think so.
All right. Who do we have, Steve? Brian, good morning.
Hey, good morning. Wow. What a conversation. You
oh,
guys
yeah.
are doing great. So, you know, I think with the... propaganda thing and the, you know, the Nazi involvement in American thought or whatever, you could just do a rudimentary thing of The Good German with George Clooney, which was a great...
Well, it is a good movie.
Yeah, it was a great movie, but I mean, it had that under political statement. You
know? One of the interesting things about America, and people always say this, well, if it's the kind of society you're describing, an empire without freedom, how is it that we have so much freedom? And the answer, I think, is that the kind of dissent and freedom that we have in our society, which is always under control, makes it clear to everybody that it really is a democracy.
Well, see, I don't want to down you guys or be adversarial with you, but
why not?
Well,
please do.
Well, okay, let me be adversarial with you. You know, our problem on the left is to, you know, and I think Newt Gingrich saw this and used it to its maximum. Is we will argue about any stupid statement that's made by, you know, somebody we don't agree with.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Well, no, we will. We will argue.
No, he's just
hours.
Being sarcastic. Go ahead.
And we'll write books and we'll do book tours and we will devote, you know, millions of pages to arguments that are just ridiculous. Now, I knew when Obama said that, I was like, wow, you know, like, you know, basically on a easy level is, what's he smoking? You know, I mean, like, there's no end to this. You know, we know that. I mean, you know, it's a 5-minute discussion that this is just, you know, a load of crap. And who cares where it's from and what the motives are? The bottom line goes, and I have to say this to you guys, Manifest Destiny, Thomas Jefferson, blah, blah, blah. Those people in those days had what they thought, and what we know now is not, but they thought they had proof that black people were, you know, should be subservient to others. They had proof that...
Well, yeah, they
had
all these rationalizations,
right,
which they called proof.
And now, nowadays, you know, it's so funny. We have all this proof that we are equal, and we are equal. You know, we're all equal. We're all born equal, you know, and we all have these things that we know, and we could, you know, blah, 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 feed the world. You know, that sounds a little idealistic, but it's true, but we won't. And you know, the bottom line goes is as long as all of us sit there and argue ridiculous statements with people who still fall back into this manifest destiny concept, these racial concepts, as long as we're going to argue this, as long as we're going to argue about the war on terror, it's going to exist.
I agree with you, and I'm going to let you go because I want to get as many people going as possible. Let's go to Chris. Is it Chris?
Yes. Hey, how's it going?
Pretty good.
Good. Well, yeah, this has been a great show to listen to. A couple of things I was thinking. There's so many different...
Well, just go for it, man.
Yeah. So many points of entry. Talking about, you know, this controlled freedom that we have, this air of freedom, but really as Occupy Wall Street and the subsequent police state that reared its ugly head behind that showed that really even our First Amendment rights are out the window.
Well, and, beginning with the earlier Sedition and Alien Acts, following the American Revolution and right after the Constitution. Also, remember that the Espionage Act and the Sedition Acts of 17 and 18 are still on the books, and people are being prosecuted by them.
Right, and they're being used. Absolutely. But really, what our freedom is about today, and this ties into the Creel Commission and the rise of propaganda, which was then turned into PR and advertising, and really, that's it. It's the privatization of those ideals that were promulgated by the Creel Commission, right? And then once the war was over, then that whole apparatus was turned to the private sector to make money.
Yeah, and you know, it's important to understand it did turn to the private sector. And during the 1920s, when the economy was very fat because Europe was in terrible shape, and there were lots of markets for our produce, for our grain and so on. And during that period of time, the American people were terribly disillusioned about war in general. But it didn't take anything more than the rise of fascism, which I guess is a major thing, to put us right back on the same track. And we've been on a war footing since 1940. Basically, we have had standing armies since that time.
And we should probably point out that we there has been no declaration of war since December 8th of 41.
That's true.
Yep, absolutely.
Okay.
And then, yeah, so what I was going to say, though, is the freedom that we enjoy is really a freedom of consumer choice.
Yes. And I get to choose Campbell's versus, I don't know, some other brand.
Right, versus, you know, the generic, right? And that is, those are my freedoms. It's my freedom to choose what I buy.
Yes, good.
And the less power I have to do that, the less I matter at all in the society.
Okay,
and,
well, go ahead. So, real quick finish up.
Yep, so, you know, and the other irony, too, to respond to Abe's comment about, well, how did we have this whole era of, you know, progressivism at the same time that we were actually regressing? And I think you can look to the ultimate irony of the 14th Amendment, which was intended to free the slaves and give them equal protection under the law, that was soon after leveraged by corporations to establish the principle of corporate personhood.
Exactly.
So at the same time that we have these laws on the books that give us the air of freedom, underneath it, they're really these repressive policies that end up taking hold. So,
yes. Thanks a lot.
Show.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Excellent call.
Thank you. Bye.
That's okay. So we got to take care of a little business.
Oh, okay.
And then I think what he said set us up brilliantly for the next segment here.
Okay.
Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 on Alternative Radio, Jeremy Scahill, the award-winning national security correspondent for The Nation magazine and the author of the bestsellers Blackwater and Dirty Wars, speaks on License to Kill. At 10, here Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Flashpoints is off today. We'll hear Law and Disorder, featuring a critical review of the film documentary We Steal Secrets, the story of WikiLeaks, and an interview with...
Yay, WikiLeaks!
an interview with attorney Sahar Francis on the nearly 5,000 Palestinian security prisoners in Israeli jails. At 11, on stage and studio, host D. Mae Roberts talks with Ken Davenport, author of a new book for the original musical play Somewhere in Time, which is being produced by Portland Center Stage. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Ava Lake interviews artist Cynthia Lottie, who has a show at PDX Contemporary Art. All this and more coming up today on your listener-supported radio station, KBOO.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what then, if the war on terror is truly over, as the president claims it
would
that look like then? We've talked a little bit about the surveillance state, the security state erected under George W. Bush. If the war on terror is truly over, we should see the dismantling of that state, right?
Yeah.
We should see certain signs that things are returning to a normal that we more closely associated with a pre-September 11th.
Of course, normal is pretty security state-based, but
it is. Something more like the normal that most of us grew up with,
right.
Let's put it that way. During the president's speech, something kind of remarkable happened. Not remarkable in that it had never happened before, because this particular woman, whom you're going to hear from in just a moment, has made it her business to show up and protest when the president makes statements in public. What was interesting about this particular protest is the amount of time which it was allowed to play out for, and then the response that the president gave to it in the midst of his remarks. So this is Medea Benjamin of Code Pink during the president's speech on the end of the war on terror last week.
Was killed. Can you tell the Muslim people their lives are as precious as our lives? Can you take the drones out of the hands of the CIA? Can you stop the signature strikes that are killing people on the basis of suspicious activities? Will you apologize to the thousands of Muslims that you have killed? Will you compensate the innocent family victims? That will make us safer.
So that was Medea Benjamin. And that was just a small segment of what she said. The president's speech essentially came to a halt while she interrupted him, and he listened, and then he commented on it afterwards. He said that she was worth talking to, that what she had to say was worth listening to. And then he went on to wax fairly philosophic about the need to get off of a permanent war footing and how dangerous that was to a democratic state such as our own, how much we needed to undo these unfortunate steps that we've taken over the past 10 years or so. It was one of those Obama moments when you listen, you go, yeah, yeah, yeah. But then usually nothing ever happens.
Well, I mean, the nothing ever happens thing also has to do with another aspect, when we talk of the overwhelming history of America, we can see this imperialism. We can see the limitations that the system has imposed. We can see the dominance of the industrial capitalist class. And we can also, at moments, realize that there are other ideas, other competing thoughts. And I think Obama, ironically, kind of characterizes that schizophrenia. That is that he presents himself definitely as a small D Democrat looking for a more fair and just society, at the same time that he continues with these same draconian policies. All of this in the context of a fight between his party, the Democrats, and the weird right-wing neo-fascist party that the Republican Party has become.
Now, the point I'm trying to make here, and the thing that you really should take away from this conversation is, as nice as that sort of rhetoric sounds from him, and as encouraging as it is to believe that we have a thoughtful president in that regard, the fact is that at nearly every opportunity, when the president's rhetoric has brushed up against the priorities of his donor class, the priorities of his donor class have won out every single time.
Oh, yeah.
And I suspect the same is going to be true this time.
Well, I don't think, you know, I think the argument in American politics between so-called liberalism, which is now characterized as the left, by the way, we've moved that far to the right. Liberalism used to be the center. There used to be a left in American dialogue. It disappeared more or less with the witch hunts against communists post-World War II. The argument between liberalism and liberal ideas as the left and conservative and reactionary ideas as the mainstream and at the far end, exemplified by the modern Republican Party, which has been taken over by, I don't know what you want to call them, but, you know, really, really hardcore right-wingers, that argument is so limited and so limiting that the other possibilities are virtually eliminated from the public discourse. So we see, oh, look how democratic it is, how fair it is. We're having this argument between the left and the right. It ain't the left. It's the center having a fight with the right.
Let's go back to the
You're point. Laughing. Why are you laughing?
You have to laugh at some point.
Otherwise, or else you cry.
Otherwise you cry or you go mad.
Crying is so unmanly. Yes.
Tim, good morning.
I'm glad you mentioned the defeat of fluoridation here last week. But unfortunately, there's a number of communities around Portland that are still fluoridated, like Beaverton and, Vancouver, Washington, and Salem, places like that. Is there any move to defluoridate these?
You know, I'm going to pass on your question because I think we really want to focus in on this larger question at this time. Well, you're asking a good question.
Let's go for defluoridation.
Okay, man.
All right. 503-231-8187. We're also taking your emails, joeandabe@yahoo.com. Who's up next, Steve? Ted, good morning.
Good morning. Yes, I was going to add to the conversation that the power structure is going to do everything they can. They're going to fight against, and they're going to try and destroy anybody that tries to take this country off the track that they want it on, which is to drive a stake through the heart of the middle class, wind up with nothing but a poor class, a subclass of people that will do anything for a dollar. They'll do all the bidding of the powers that be, and they don't want to see anybody else have an opportunity to have what they can have obtained.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you very much. Right. You know, I have to, in commenting about this caller, there is a shift going on. I believe that at this point in history, and I don't know that this will be a permanent shift, but at this point in history, the United States is, which it was often in its history, the supplier of the raw materials, of the things grown on the land, of the land being dug up, of the oil, of the gas, and so on. The earliest history, the reason why the colonies succeeded in Virginia in particular, was that they could produce indigo and rice, and later tobacco, and then still cotton. Later cotton. Yeah. And that is what made the United States a wealthy nation. And that is where our power rested, that is in the land. Now we're going, we're at a place where we're essentially digging up our land. We're destroying our rivers. We're destroying our water. Our aquifers are endangered, all of which is involved in the production of natural gas and oil products and other export items. Meanwhile, the American people as a people, with a great standard of living, relatively speaking, face the fact that the markets are not here. The markets are in China and India and Indonesia and elsewhere. So the manufacturing of the things and the sale of the things becomes more and more a phenomenon outside of the United States, and we merely provide raw materials.
Turning of the tables.
Well, it's a very, you know, it's a very interesting pattern, and I think it's very unfortunate.
And who benefits?
Well, the wealthy.
The wealthy meaning, what does that mean now?
Well, what do you mean, what does it mean?
What does it mean now? The wealthy benefit.
Well, it means they get more wealth.
No, 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 no. Who are the wealthy in this context?
Oh, gosh.
The global ruling, the ownership class.
Well, the ownership class,
right.
Sure.
Those people who control the levers of capitalism such that they're able to benefit on this scale.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. So it renders phrases like "Buy American" meaningless.
Well, yeah.
It doesn't really matter where in the world raw materials come from anymore. It doesn't really matter where they're assembled, where they're ultimately purchased. Who benefits in the end might have nothing to do with any of those locations.
You're right. And in fact, the struggles that people like you and I are often engaged in is trying to find wholesome food when the food has been totally polluted by Monsanto and others, or trying to discover ways not to destroy the environment when in fact all the big money is on environmental destruction, mountaintop removal. Even at the smallest level in southwestern Oregon, where people are dredging, based on late 1800s law, people are dredging and destroying the beautiful river systems to dig up a little bit of gold.
What I'm saying is maybe the time has passed for us to organize as members of a nation state trying to reform our democratic institutions. Maybe it's time for us to organize as the global 99%.
Well,
resisting
I think
the
so.
Ownership class.
I think so, but remember, patriotism is the playing card of the ruling class, and it is very, very heavily played.
Yeah.
I mean, after 9/11, Bill Maher?
Yeah.
Was kicked off the air on ABC, I believe it was, because he remarked that, something like, well, you know, this is what happens when you're mean to people.
No, that's not what he said. He said, say what you will about the terrorists, I'm paraphrasing here, but at least they're not cowards. They had personal bravery, was what he was saying.
Well, same difference, but yes.
Right, okay. Yeah, and he got kicked off the air.
Yeah, and then he got kicked off the air, and now he's on cable. And cable, of course, is something that you get to afford, not that you get to have with your basic channels.
Let's go back to the phones. Who's next? Michael, good morning.
Good morning, guys.
Good morning. What's on your mind?
Well, I was interested to hear you talk about third-party authority, and I thought that's so interesting because when you look at fluoride, the third-party authority was, all the dentists and everybody says we should put fluoride in the water, science says we should put fluoride in the water, and people of your political persuasion were, like, completely skeptical about that. And then
people
when
of our
comes,
political
when
persuasion
warming,
were divided on this particular issue.
Well, okay, but there was a large component of you guys that was like, you know, well, I don't care what they say. I know that it's a bad
thing. Well, wait, Michael, remember that there is much data that disputes the assumptions of the pro-fluoride community.
Okay, fine.
Scientific data out of articles that are judged by, you know, that are peer-reviewed and so on.
And
so it isn't like we're fighting science or something.
Well, you know, then when it comes to global warming, it's completely flipped around the other way, and it's just so interesting that the same people who reject the scientific consensus, and there is a huge scientific consensus in favor of fluoride, when you look at global warming, they say, you know, the people who are skeptical, they're, quote, deniers, naming them after Holocaust deniers, a really slimy rhetorical tactic, in my opinion. So, you know, you pick and choose.
I think we all pick and choose, number one. Number two, I think the difference, you're creating an analogy between one argument about one thing with another argument about another thing.
Well,
And the fact is, what you're saying is, well, this kind of argument is bad because it's a bad kind of argument.
No, that's not what I'm saying.
Well, I'm confused. Are you actually arguing, for example, that A, fluoride is good because the majority of scientific opinion, in your opinion, is in favor of it, and B, that the weather issue, that the climate issue, is in fact an issue which could be argued?
I'm definitely saying that the climate issue should be argued because I'm one of the people who argue it for very good technical reasons as a computer scientist. But leaving that aside for the moment, because you probably don't want to go off into that on this show.
Not on this show.
All I'm trying to say is that people pick and choose, and then they come up with their best rationalization, like, oh, the scientists are behind what I like.
Oh, I see what you're saying. No, you're right. I mean, I will absolutely plead that my own discoveries, my own beliefs, my own investigations make me decide things, and that they will be sometimes in contradiction to other things.
Well, And,
yeah,
you know,
but so?
Well, the point is that if you realized that people use rationality when it suits them and they use emotionality when it suits them, then you'd maybe finally come to a place where people could actually communicate with each other across the lines that divide them. Instead of, I mean, what goes on now is, I mean, when I talk to people about the climate, they get so snotty with me because of all the other scientists. And, you know, they won't even listen to what I have to say.
Well, I think fear drives most of these issues, unfortunately. And your point is valid. That is, people don't want to listen to each other. I don't want to digress into the two issues, either fluoride or the question of global warming. But, you know,
I don't want to either.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to say one other thing when you said about the war on terror. How could you have a war on a concept?
Yeah.
What that was an exercise in political correctness, and as a result, they didn't want to say the truth. You know, the government didn't really want to say the truth for marketing reasons. The truth is, it was a war against jihadist Islam.
Yes.
That's the truth.
Yeah.
And that's a war that isn't going to stop just because Obama says, well, we're not going to fight it anymore. You know, you'll still have the Tsarnaev brothers blowing up the Boston Marathon, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You still have maniacs motivated by this ideology hacking up the corpses of people they've killed in Britain, you know? I mean, the idea is out there, and the idea is as powerful as the idea of Nazism was in its time.
Well, excluding your last statement, I'm going to let you go because there's a lot of people who want to get on the air. But excluding the last part of it, the equating of kind of a fundamentalist Islam with Nazism.
No, jihadist Islam.
Ah, jihadist Islam. I think you have a point there. I think it's always scary for me and from my point of view when people believe that their religious beliefs, and by the way, Christianity has done this just as often as Islam, the idea that a religious set of values and beliefs is by itself, because it's God mandated, it's okay to do whatever you have to do to spread it. I think that's a terrible idea, and I think it's a dangerous idea, and I think, yeah. But when you arouse it, when you encourage it, when you use our own economic and military power to make events that seem to thwart it, yeah, you're going to run into this kind of problem for sure. Yeah.
Well, you know, I don't think you can blame us on the existence of jihadist Islam.
I'm not trying to blame us for the rise of jihad, although we could spend a long time discussing exactly how modern Islamic fundamentalism has evolved. Anyway, I want to thank you for the call, Michael.
Sure.
Thanks
bye-bye.
Very much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so again, I want to go back to my original point. We have been engaged in a dial tone.
We haven't been engaged in a dial tone. Yes, we have. Okay. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio program. KBOO 90.7 FM is your station.
Hey, he took it off.
We got rid of the dial tone.
We got rid of the
Hallelujah.
Dial tone.
Hallelujah.
Yay.
All right. Today we're talking about the alleged end of the war on terror. Will it happen? Is it meaningful? will we ever, as a democratic republic, shift away from our permanent wartime footing, which Joe claims we've been on since at least 1918?
Well, I would argue that the entire manifest... Okay, we are having a little technical problem, so people have to be just simply cut out. They can't be faded out. So, too bad. All right, let's go to Marie. Hi, Marie.
Good morning.
Oh, we're stuck.
We are having some technical difficulties. Oh. Callers, hang in there. We'll get to you as soon as we're able.
Yeah, meanwhile, we'll talk, I guess.
Yeah, meanwhile, we'll talk.
Yeah, I want to be clear about this. the creation of the PR state, which I just invented the idea of PR state. The creation of the PR state, which Chris Hedges and others, Jeremy Scahill and so on, talk about quite a bit, is so much an accepted part of our culture. The neat thing about the AMC show Mad Men is that it gets into that world without any critique of it and simply presents it, you know.
I disagree. I think the whole show is a critique of that world.
Oh,
but go
okay.
Ahead. Go
All
ahead.
Right. I'll go agree ahead. With you. I mean, right. Overall, it's a critique, but it's accepting of it as a presentation.
Sure.
And I think that all of us grow up in that environment. It's very hard to break away from that environment. And I think that the success of it is so obvious. We have essentially known as a people, not our audience, but as a people, that all left-wing political thought is suspect, and that the ultimate left-wing political thought is not anarchism, but communism, and that communism is inherently bad. And the proof of it, of course, is the failure of and the aggression of the socialist empire of the Soviet Union.
Right.
So now all of us are left bereft of a nation state to say, oh, look at what they've accomplished. Can't say it about China either. Look at what they've accomplished. You have to say these are ideals. These are ideas whose time has apparently not yet really come.
I'm going to go out on a limb here.
Yes.
I'm going to say that the 30-year trend towards disinvestment in public education in the United States has made it far easier for people to be persuaded by emotion rather than reason, which you claim is the principal tool of the modern propaganda state.
Well, I agree with you. In fact, one of the most eerie things to me I grew up in a mediocre educational system in Southern California, but it was good enough that I could figure stuff out. And my textbooks, which were really quite conservative, not right-wing, but conservative, helped me to understand historical fact, for example. I am not sure, and I teach quite a bit at the universities and have in the community colleges, I'm not sure that the young people I'm encountering are at all aware of the human-created environment in which they function.
Well, I'd say it's not just the young people. Consider in 2001, 2002, the President of the United States was able to make a statement as nonsensical as, they hate us for our freedom, and have a significant number of people buy that statement and not evaluate it any further than that.
Right. Right. And even now we are a nation engaging in what would be regarded in the past as war crimes and see them as particularly okay. Okay, we're having equipment problems. The equipment is, well, you read that to me. I cannot understand what he said.
Okay, we're having some trouble, but we're going to make another stab at getting a caller on the air. We'll see how it goes. Who do we have? Steve.
Too early a stab. Too early a stab. Totally missed a vital part. Yeah.
How many duels have ended because of that?
Too early a stab. Yeah, you cut my arm, but I can still.
All right. 503-231-8187 is the number to call if we're able to get callers back on the air. My name is Abe. That is Joe. We've got a particularly wide-ranging conversation today. That's why I'd really like to get back to some phone callers.
Well, yeah, but I really want, if I can leave our listeners with one clear idea, which is valid, which is that the techniques of propaganda, which merge seamlessly into the techniques of advertising, and all of that is what dominates most of our awareness and our consciousness most of the time. Carl, you're on the air.
Oh, hi.
Carl,
hi.
Good morning.
We reached you.
Okay, great. Have you ever read Smedley Butler?
Have we ever read the what?
Smedley Butler. Smedley Darling.
I've heard the name. I don't think I've ever read Smedley Butler.
Yeah, go ahead. Tell us about Smedley.
Hello?
Are you there?
I think we lost him. Sorry about that, Carl.
Or somebody. Anyway, all right. I will continue to talk a little bit about this whole Committee on Public Information, Committee on Public Education, and that the pattern that changed America from trying to be, in fact, electing a president with Woodrow Wilson in 1912 and 1916, that we kept us out of, he said, I'll keep you out of war. He keeps us out of war, to a situation in which we swing our support to Great Britain and in opposition to the Central Powers in Europe. That whole process was so effective and such a good model that it persisted well beyond World War I and was very useful in stamping out the incipient and growing radical labor movement typified by the IWW, and in fact it was very important in understanding exactly how it was that all left-wing thought was effectively discredited for a long, long time. The one time that you began to see a return to left-wing thinking was in the objective conditions of the Great Depression. Interestingly, today we're in another Great Depression, and there absolutely is no comparative left, although...
The Occupy Movement.
The Occupy Movement is the thing that's closest to that, and we now know that just like the communists, just like the socialists, the Occupy Movement is being infiltrated constantly by the FBI, by private agencies, by state agencies, and local police agencies. So it's a pattern that repeats. It'll be interesting to see if the objective conditions of the United States, the failing of wealth for ordinary citizens and the increasing wealth in the 1%, will have any overall effect in the face of a vast mechanism of assumption and propaganda that has been built over more than 100 years. You're silent.
After the Great Depression, the malefactors of great wealth, to borrow a phrase from Roosevelt,
yes,
essentially paid the price for what they had done to bring about the Depression in terms of their share of the national wealth. The share controlled by the 1% in the post-Depression, post-war era is a smaller share than that controlled by the 1% now. The 1% now have brought us into another Great Depression, as you say, but nobody in that class has yet to pay a price, either in terms of economic power, in terms of political power, or in terms of actual freedom. Nobody's gone to jail this time for tanking the global economy.
Yeah, no,
that's a marked difference in, you said, the, what is the term that you just used? The physical condition of the United States?
Yeah, well, the I don't know what term I use, but the fact of the matter is, objectively, American incomes have not risen for more than 10 years. More than 10 years.
Right.
And objectively, the wealth of the 1% has gigantically risen.
It has.
And the executives in companies make so many more times what their workers make when they get to work. So,
whereas the Great Depression, its aftermath was the establishment and imposition of a liberal power structure.
Yeah, with a notion of cooperation between the working class and the ruling class.
Which held sway for several decades. Well, that was the outcome of the Great Depression.
I don't know, several decades.
But there's been no similar readjustment this time around.
No, and there probably won't be because the effectiveness of this vast propaganda machine is so enormous. The sense of the social construction of reality that we have today is so powerful that it will take, if it's going to happen, an enormous educational effort all over the place, and the professoriate, the intelligentsia, who were liberal, who fought their way through the McCarthy era, and who came after that, the professors beginning in '68 or so, all have aged. They're all disappearing, and the new generation are, I think, much more careful and much more reasoned, and I put quotes around that term, than those who were outraged, for example, by the Vietnam War.
And why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's the case because as time passes, the whole argument, the whole discourse of intellectual life has moved significantly to the right. We are essentially under the influence, for example, in economics, of the Chicago School, rather than being under the influence of people the like Krugman.
The Keynesian school. Right.
Or the Keynesian school.
Right.
Yeah.
What boggles my mind is that Americans can see with their own two eyes the damage that the 1%, that the ruling class has wrought. And we can see the ongoing cancer that besets the middle class, largely because so much wealth is concentrated in the hands of a very few. You can see that with their own two eyes, yet they still swallow the formulation that nothing can be done in terms of reallocation of the national wealth, because to do so would be to injure the job creators upon whom all of us depend.
We're running out of time. Another time we'll talk about the way in which our society has become sadistic.
Sorry about the technical problems today. We really wanted to get to a lot more phone calls, and we'll have to make up for that next time.
But you stay with us. Stay with KBOO, because it speaks the truth. Often. From those lands to Tiananmen Square. It's coming from the field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
Good morning, Pee-wee.
Morning, Mr. Breakfast.
Start your morning right and come celebrate 45 years with the Fruits, Nuts, and Flakes at the first ever Breakfast with the Boo, Saturday, June 1st, 9 a.m. to noon. There'll be live music, pancake flipping, bluegrass picking, and so much more. That's Saturday, June 1st, 9 a.m. to noon at the Matt Dishman Community Center, 77 Northeast Knott Street. More information can be found at kabu.fm.
Biscuit, pancake. Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's 9 o'clock. Here's what's coming up this morning on KBOO. First on alternative radio, Jeremy Scahill, the award-winning national security correspondent for The Nation magazine and author of the bestsellers Blackwater and Dirty Wars, speaks on License to Kill. At 10, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Flashpoints is off today. We'll hear Law and Disorder, featuring a critical review of the film documentary We Steal Secrets, The Story of WikiLeaks, and an interview with attorney Sahar Francis on the nearly 5,000 Palestinian security prisoners in Israeli jails. At 11 on stage in studio, host Dime Roberts talks with Ken Davenport, author of a new book for the original musical play, Somewhere in Time, which is being produced by Portland Center Stage. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Ava Lake interviews artist Cynthia Lottie, who has a show at PDX Contemporary Art. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Now let's go to Alternative Radio.
What crime did the 6-year-old girl commit against the United States so that her arm was a half a mile away from her head when they found her body? What crime did she commit? Because this cuts to the heart of who we are as a society. It's being done in all of our names. And whether you support the drone strikes as a smarter way of war, or you're against them because you think they're immoral, you have to be against the targeting of people whose identity we don't know, evidence against whom we don't possess, the names of which we don't know. You have to say that is not right on a moral level. And I'm not a lawyer, but I would venture to guess that it's probably illegal too. It's long past due that we had that discussion in this country.
That's Jeremy Scahill, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Jeremy Scahill on License to Kill. Drones represent a new era in warfare. They are the White House, Pentagon, CIA weapon of choice. Clean 21st century death from above. No body bags, no weeping mothers, at least not in the homeland. The president decides who lives and who dies. It's a dangerous world. Enemies are lurking everywhere. Let's get them before they get us. Georgetown law professor Rosa Brooks, among others, are ringing alarm bells. She told the Senate committee, "Right now, we have the executive branch making a claim that it has the right to kill anyone anywhere on earth at any time for secret reasons, based on secret evidence, in a secret process undertaken by unidentified officials. That's not the rule of law. That frightens me," she said. Like Bob Dylan tells us in his song License to Kill, "But there's a woman on my block, sitting there in a cold chill. She say, who gonna take away his license to kill?" Our guest today is Jeremy Scahill. He's the award-winning national security correspondent for The Nation magazine and author of the bestsellers Blackwater and Dirty Wars. He has reported from war zones around the world. His work has sparked several congressional investigations. He's also the subject of the film Dirty Wars, an official selection of the 2013 Sundance Film Festival. He spoke at Town Hall in Seattle. And now, Jeremy Scahill.
I got deep into this world of covert operations. And what was sort of amazing to me, given my orientation and where I came from, is that after the Blackwater book came out, I started to get emails and phone calls, or people would show up at my event who had been in Iraq or Afghanistan with Blackwater guys. And they were Navy SEALs or Delta Force or Army Rangers, or they were helicopter pilots, or they were colonels that were in charge of conventional operations. And, you know, they would say a similar thing, all of them. You know, "I don't really care for your politics very much, but you were 100% right about Blackwater." They didn't like them either. And I ended up getting to know a bunch of guys from this special operations community. So the book that I wrote, Dirty Wars, it tells a couple of stories. On the one hand, it tracks the men and sometimes women, but largely it's men who are doing the killing in these operations from the CIA and from the military's elite force called the Joint Special Operations Command. But it also tells the stories of the civilians who live in countries like Yemen or Somalia or Afghanistan who are on the other side of these operations. And you know, woven between them are stories of warlords in Somalia who are on the CIA payroll and are being paid to hunt down and kill or capture people that have been designated as enemies of the United States, or people that